Welcome back. My name is Jay Sharma. I use any pronouns. I'm originally from Boston and Queens, and I've been at the Hub for about 6 or 7 months. And I had the pleasure of speaking with Joshua, if you want to give yourself an introduction.
Yeah, so my name is Joshua Puller, but you can call me Josh. I use he, him pronouns. I've been helping at the Hub for about 2 years, maybe from the beginning of 2022, I would say. Yeah, and I'm pretty local to the Hub, so I'm really lucky to live, you know, just a few blocks away.
Yeah. How did you get connected?
So it's a funny story. I ordered groceries online and the website messed up. And so it sent me duplicates of everything that I had ordered.
Yeah.
And I had ordered maybe like 2 kg of carrots. So I had 4 kg. I had like 100 carrots.
Freaking carrots.
And I love cooking. It's like one of my passions. I love pickling.
Yeah.
But I was like exhausted. I had done everything you can do to a carrot. I had done.
Yeah.
And, you know, I walked up and down Broadway and I remembered seeing the fridges, you know. Mm-hmm. This is a great opportunity for me to go and drop some food off at the fridge. I didn't know anyone here. Like, it was just kind of like happenstance. I just came. There was a couple people who sat outside. I remember now it was Crystal, who's one of the volunteers here, and she was sat outside. And, you know, it was a really quick interaction, but she was just like, oh, thank you. You know, and I was moving on quickly as well.
Right.
And it wasn't until another maybe like, I'm going to say 3 or 4 months, that idea came back around to like, check out this space.
Inside.
Yeah, no, I found it. I you know, I've like went on Google Maps, like, what is that place called? Okay, it's called Collective Focus. Then I went to Instagram, checked it out. And then I saw that there are open houses and I was like, okay. So I emailed like, hey, when's the next open house? I think I emailed it in December and they were like, oh, it's coming up in January or February. So, yeah, I came to the open house and, yeah, met everyone and that was it. Then I was like, yeah, I want to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so have you done something similar growing up back in the UK? Or is this sort of like, it just felt natural to get involved in it?
Yeah, I think, so where my kind of thinking was what my thinking was it was the beginning of the year and I wanted to volunteer or I wanted to participate in charity. I didn't really necessarily have a sense of like what mutual aid was at that point. It's not something that I had like grown up doing or been involved with. The only interaction with mutual aid that I had was during the pandemic where my partner, Hannah, had been volunteering with a group called Bed-Stuy Strong, which they kind of were a network of neighbors in Bed-Stuy that would go and buy groceries and then deliver them to people that needed them in Bed-Stuy. The people that were asking for groceries could give anything, give a list of whatever they wanted or needed. And I think the sort of basis of that was that network was trying to activate people who were either like affluent or had money or were able to continue working during the pandemic and help folks that didn't have access to food, didn't have access to money or even to like working during that time. And it's basically like redistributing through that. My partner started helping out with that. And then I also kind of went along and did some of the, you know, we went to the grocery store, we picked up the stuff, read the list, delivered it to the people.
Right.
And I didn't do it too many times, but it was still, it was a meaningful experience for me in that time. And I was really proud that that was something that she had picked up and that I could kind of like interact with at that time. So, but I, you know, I did that a couple of times and then that network started to maybe like fall away from its prevalence or need. Or found other ways to sort of connect neighbors. Hunter and I just didn't really interact with it anymore at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you did get connected to the Hub, and you started showing up, what was the capacity at which you were involved, and how did you feel? How did you find your fit here at the Hub?
Yeah, so at that time, I was working full time, and I would come to, let's say, like the Monday Trader Joe's drop. Mm-hmm. So I'd come in the evening, or I would come to the events that were put on in evening, you know, like fundraisers and stuff like that. But then, so let's say that was in January. At the end of February, I lost the job that I was working in. And so I suddenly had all this free time. Yeah. And I was sort of lucky enough to like have some other sort of like small freelance stuff that kept me afloat and kept like money coming in. But it was at that point that I really like kind of threw myself into like Hub life, you mm-hmm, know? Mm-hmm. So I started coming to the Tuesday distros, and I would come, you know, maybe like at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. and just help open up, yeah, and then sort of be here for all of the commotion of like getting the food in and then, you know, setting up for the distro that begins, you know, around 12 or 1.
Right.
And then I would sort of leave about 2. Yeah. I just loved kind of just coming in, and there's always something to do at the Hub,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And for me, that is really activating for me, and it doesn't tire me out to kind of be like on my toes and see someone or something needs to be done.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just like exhilarating, I would say, to just do this thing and give this food out to people and look at the people that we're giving the food to, and mm-hmm, you know, also taking food for myself, and through that experience, like learning and understanding the principles of like what is mutual aid, you know.
Right.
And sort of learning, like, you know, I talked about this with my partner a lot, like I still had money coming in, but I would also like, you know, take food when I needed it as well. And just kind of understanding that, like, I think that the resource was there for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And take what you can,
take what you need, leave what you can.
Take what you need, leave what you can,
right,
you know? And so I think that was really important, just every time coming, just being like, you know, what is my need right now?
Right.
And yeah, just kind of being attuned to like what my neighbors need as well, and, mm-hmm, and everyone else here, and
yeah,
and understanding that, you know, for myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also it's like feeling comfortable enough to be on the other side of that support, mm-hmm, and saying that, like, you know, in order for this network or community that we're building, this world that we're envisioning of, you know, support is needed and support is given, but also we as individuals also need support. And so feeling comfortable enough to be able to say, yeah, I do need some groceries. I do, you know, I could use this, I could use that. It sort of, you know, it humanizes the work and it brings it a bit closer to where we are. So I think that's something that I noticed as well with the distros and with Mutual Aid as well. It's like standing firm in that, like, yeah, this is totally okay. And there's an abundance mindset that comes with that. And, you know, knowing that there's enough to go around and that we can feed everyone and we can help everyone to an extent.
Yeah. And what really drew me to, you know, continue to keep coming back was, I think before I joined the Hub and before I understood what mutual aid was, I was interested in charity or like just taking part in charity work. But then it was just like so clear to me after spending like 2 times in the Hub, like what that difference, mm-hmm, is between like what charity is, which is where you give someone something, and what mutual aid is where you make something together, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that I was just sold on that. And that was just like a complete like revolution for me. I was like, yeah, you give people and you work on the tools to allow people to like support themselves, mm-hmm, including yourself,
mm-hmm,
you know? And rather than, okay, we have this money, we have this resource, and we're going to give it to you in this way, and you're going to take it in that way or not at all.
Right.
You know, that was once that kind of clicked for me, I was like, oh, that's so special.
Yeah.
And that's how I want to live my life. And that, this is just like a instant core like mm-hmm. tenet of my life at that point. Once all of those,
it just kind of unlocks.
Yeah. It just made sense,
right?
You know.
And so, what is that like to be met with that lesson or that learning in a place like Brooklyn or in New York? You know, to know that like all these things work in together, and I'm a part of the system, and to be cognizant of that in a place that you didn't grow up. You know.
Yeah. So I think part of it is a kind of story of, you know, I think as soon as I moved to the US, and I'm from London, England, as soon as I moved to the US, I you know, I felt part of this, mm-hmm. but I also, you know, and I consider myself an immigrant. But the means in which I came to the US was through work. At least like that's how, like I got a visa to work here. I worked like a corporate job.
Right.
And so my experience of coming to the US is very different from many other people's, right? It's very privileged, like, avenue to get here. And I was young when I moved here. I was like 23. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, New York was like kind of like the fun playground, you know? And I was like, okay, yeah, there's like so much to see and do. And it was mm-hmm. it's all like for me, right? And then, you know, I grew up and I'd become more connected with the place. It feels like home. And I think there's also some sort of like connection with more like American ideals. Mm. One thing that really became kind of like clear to me once I moved here was like in the UK, we have a royal family and I'm not a fan of them. And I wasn't a fan of them when I left the UK, but that the idea of like we are not equal in the UK because we have that system became like super clear. And that was like even from just like listening to or reading like the very basic like Martin Luther King Jr. quotes. I'm not going to try and repeat them, but or kind of the sense of like none of us are free until we're all free, or none of us are equal until we're all equal, right? So that was kind of like the first step of like, oh, the way I grew up in an unjust society in the mm-hmm. UK. Mm-hmm. So that was like step one. And then I would say like, I came here on like basically like the eve of like the Trump election. Mm-hmm. And so this was the first time that I started protesting, going out, being like vocal,
right.
Taking my politics to the street and like learning what that was about. And then the big change was like 2020, mm. where we had the pandemic. We had like the George Floyd protests. And, you know, up until that moment, whenever I would like protest, I would be a little bit scared because I'm an immigrant. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm a privileged like person in that, I'm always like, wow, I don't want, if I'm like protesting and I get arrested or like some shit goes down, like, it jeopardizes me.
It jeopardizes where you are and all your connections and everything you built up here.
Yeah. Like my partner's here, like my friends are here, my life is here now. But in 2020, I was like, I don't care. Like my neighbors are out here. Like my neighbors, like live in Bed-Stuy. Like my neighbors, like on each side are like black, brown mm-hmm. people. Like these are the people that this system is hurting right now mm-hmm. and historically has hurt. And so at that point I was like, I don't care what happens to me. Obviously I did and I took precautions as well, but that sense of like, I have to be outside right now and I have to do this, mm-hmm. you know? And if I don't, then I can't move through this community in the same way. Mm. That was maybe like the big realization or the big kind of like consciousness shift for me. And then I would say like that idea percolated for a little bit. And then when I found mutual aid, I was like, oh, this is great. Because truthfully for me, I really don't like protesting. And I'm going out like shouting. There's energy to it and it's exciting, but then you go home, you know? And you're like, okay.
What did we accomplish?
Where
is this going?
Yeah. And when I came to the hub, I realized like, oh, these people never stopped like thinking about it. They went home. And they did something.
Yeah.
They did something more.
Right.
You know, so that was like, that was kind of like, that's my, journey through, like, I think how I got here and yeah. why once I found the hub, I was like, oh, I'm gonna stay here.
Yeah.
Like, it's important that I be here yeah. for myself.
Right, right, right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And so if we can talk a little bit more about your work and your passions and maybe even your childhood growing up, like, what was that like growing up in London? And did you always know you wanted to come to the States or to New York? Or how did that part kind of work?
Yeah, I think, so I grew up in London, born in 1992.
Shout out 1992.
Shout out 1992. Are you 1992 as well?
Hell no. I just never, heard somebody shout out their birth year when they introduce themselves. Yeah. That's dope. This, my older sister, she's born in 90, so I got love for the early 90s.
One of my first experiences in the US was like going to get, trying to get a bank account.
Yeah.
I went to Bank of America and like the woman like looked at my stuff and she was like, oh yeah, 992, shout out 992.
Yeah.
And then they denied me the bank account.
Oh, damn.
So I grew up in London and I grew up in South London in a place called Peckham, which, I always think that it's kind of like very similar to Bed-Stuy. I would call it, it's not a term that maybe is like used in the UK, but I would call it like a historically black area mm-hmm. of London.
Mm-hmm.
So like that's the kind of like community that I grew up in. And yeah, as I grew up, my sort of passion when I was growing up was acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to performing arts school. I went to a school called the Brit School, which is like basically kind of like the school in Fame, okay. you know, like the famous alumni are like Amy Winehouse, Adele, Tom Holland.
Entertainers and performers.
And that's what I wanted to do when I was a kid. And I think by the time I left, I didn't have like a strong sense of myself in that I thought that I could like become an actor. I really kind of like, I didn't have the self-esteem. After I finished, yeah. Like I auditioned for like all of the big acting schools in London and I kind of like bombed the audition. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that bad, but I just don't think that I had kind of like that presence at that time.
Yeah.
You know? And so I kind of changed my interest in terms of like my working life was I stepped behind the camera rather than in front of it, right?
Right, right.
So I learned how to video edit when I was at school and I studied film and kind of like rolled on my working life from there. I became, you know, a video mm-hmm. person, video producer, video editor. My other big passion is I do a martial art called Kendo, which is basically fencing, is full contact. I have traveled around the world doing that. So I've been to Japan, I've been to Korea, been all across Europe.
And you started this while?
This was in London. I started this when I was like 16.
Okay. And do you still practice?
I still practice, yeah. So I've traveled, it's been a great way to travel around the US. Like I've been to Los Angeles to train, I've been to Detroit. Been like all up and down like East Coast. Like first time I went to Boston was for Kendo.
Yeah.
And yeah, like that more than like any work or anything like that has been like kind of like passion. And in a true sense, it is like, you know, martial art, the art aspect of it. It's a very subjective martial art. It's very beautiful. We wear armor.
Mm-hmm.
It's really tough. You know, it's like, it's exhausting to do, but, I love the community that is like, it's such a small kind of community right. worldwide, you know, like pretty much everyone who does Kendo still uses like Facebook to connect.
Oh, wow.
And like, yeah. I could go anywhere in the world that had a Kendo club.
Yeah.
And I would meet someone that knew someone that I know.
Wow.
Or has like practiced with them.
Yeah.
And probably like that, you know, I'd practice with them. They're like, let's go get a beer afterwards.
Yeah.
If I needed equipment, they would supply it. Like probably if I needed like a sofa to sleep on,
yeah,
like
yeah,
probably
yeah,
find
yeah.
it.
That's incredible.
And so, you know, maybe that was like my first idea of like mutual aid in a way.
But and that's also like, that's the community that of people that reaches, it's sort of instilling those, that principles of like, you are welcome.
Yeah. At the same time, you know, it's a martial art that has like its roots in Japan and Korea as well. So it's very hierarchical.
Okay.
And so it's, you know, I have one foot in this like very hierarchical world.
Right.
And then, like, obviously, like, collective focus, mutual aid is very, like, non-hierarchical.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, like, one of the interesting balances of my life, at least.
I mean, it makes sense to be able to stand in both. Because there is both in the world. And, you know, even if we are envisioning and try to build a world of, you know, non-hierarchy and community bonds and everything, the system of patriarchy, of hierarchy, of these systems, that still exists. And so being able to weave that in and understand both, I think, allows you to maybe see both and have perspectives and figure out how, you know, how can lessons be informed? How can we move and sort of evolve and to figure out what works best for the most amount of people?
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I hope it does work that way. And I think that Kendo has been like such a wonderful like energy in my life. And so as I kind of think about like my ethics as a person to and especially in the sort of like non-hierarchical sense of like community sense, to just completely like be like, oh well, I don't mess with that idea anymore of hierarchy or whatever, that doesn't feel right, you know?
Right.
And you're right, like the world is still, there's still so much hierarchy in the world, and it is something that I think we are going to have to navigate.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I want to talk more about the community that you find in Kendo and how that maybe like turned you on to mutual aid now.
Yeah. I think that the in Kendo, everyone has to show up for themselves and each other, right. You know? So typically people that teach that martial art, they aren't making a wage. Like they have a job, and then like running the club is their kind of like passion on the side. Just
doing it for the love, yeah.
Yeah. And so people are like, you know, they'll go work their job, and then like they get all their equipment, and then they'll like rush to the dojo, like set it all up.
Yeah.
You know, and so in that sense, like being part of a club like that, you also kind of learn the structure of, it's almost like a little village community kind of structure, because you'll see like, okay, this person is like the treasurer, mm-hmm. and like is handling everyone, like paying their fee to practice each time. This person is like the events coordinator, you know, anywhere between like, okay, let's all go to the pub after practice, or let's do the Christmas party or holiday party. You know, to like, oh, let's all go to the park and like have a barbecue because it's the weather's nice. Right. You know, within the practice, there are people who step up and like will lead different parts of the practice. And then on the interpersonal level, there, you know, you meet people who are really challenging. You fight people, right? And so you meet people that beat you up,
mm-hmm.
and your ego gets like hurt from that. And then you meet people that you beat up. Eventually, mm-hmm. you know, and your ego gets a boost from that.
Yeah.
And you start to navigate like these kind of novel interpersonal connections where maybe easily you feel you have a little bit of power over them, or you're able to kind of like dominate them in a fight, you know. And not that that's kind of like the idea of it, you know, a lot of like what we practice is just like drills and stuff, but when you do fight someone, it's really activating.
Yeah.
You know, you like look at them in the eye. You're wearing this armor, and it's you know, a lot of your senses are kind of like taken away in a way, and someone's like shouting at you, and they're running at you, and they're trying to hit you with a sword.
They're trying to attack. They're trying to beat you.
Yeah, and so you learn a lot about like, wow, what do I do in that situation? You know, the sort of like perfect reaction to someone trying to attack you in Kendo is you try and attack them at the same time, and you try and be faster than them, or your technique is slightly better than them. And So, yeah, I think within that community, you just kind of like, you get a sense of so many kind of dynamics that maybe some people experience in their family, but mm-hmm. or their friends or their school. But then there's this kind of like this combat aspect to it yeah. that can be elevating for these kind of like interpersonal relationships.
No, that's great insight. I think competition is something that we sort of interact with a lot as children
yeah.
in different formats. And then as we get older, we're sort of maybe encouraged to not be so competitive. But I think competition brings out a lot of great things.
Yeah.
And like the self-determination and the will and the discipline. One of my favorite coaches, I'm a huge fan of basketball, Joe Mazzulla, he talks about competition all the time and he trains jiu-jitsu and he's yeah. always, you know, making these grand analogies and sort of like silly to think about, like these guys are just playing basketball. But there is that aspect of like, if you can get your mind to sort of live in that world of like, I'm trying to be better, you know, yeah. I'm trying to beat the person in front of me because I want to be better.
Yeah.
It sort of sets you up to like show up better for the people around you and to unlock the potential that's on the other side of competition, of putting yourself out there and also opening yourself up to loss and to embarrassment and into defeat. And there's a lot of things on the other side of those, you know, things that we cut ourselves off from even having the chance to contend with.
Yeah. I think that, you know, one of the things we say in Kendo is core tenet of Kendo is to cultivate a strong spirit through the practice, you know? And I agree, like competition is really important, and it's a good container for a lot of strong emotions that we feel, you know. And I think that through experiencing that through the container of like doing kendo means that I can kind of move through the world where, let's say, like in my work life, I don't feel that I have to like beat other people. Like I don't have to like, it's like our labor is not competition, or at least it shouldn't be. Well, you know, when you work for a while, you start to realize yeah. like it is, mm-hmm. or some people want to treat you that way. And so I think it's been really important for me to not feel that pressure, at least on myself, because I know what it's like to like yeah. be in real competition right. with someone. I don't know what it is to lose, and I know what it is to win.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I can kind of move through the rest of the world like a little bit like gentler, maybe. Right.
Yeah. And so how often are you able to practice kendo?
I'll practice maybe max 3 times a week.
Okay.
Usually two times a week. Okay. I practice both in Manhattan and Brooklyn.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that your main sort of like wellness practice, or do you find other ways to sort of like, you know, get outside of your mind and into your body, or get outside of your body into your mind? How do you sort of,
as
you've gotten older and as you've grown for, you know, over 10 years with this practice, are there ways that you've sort of figured out, like, this is how you operate best?
Yeah. So it's definitely my number one wellness practice. I've been doing it now, like I'm 32. So I started when I was 16. So I've been doing it longer now in my life than I haven't been doing it.
Oh, yeah,
it.
More than, yeah.
So that was amazing. When I kind of like found that out, and I was like looking at the day, I was like, oh, that's amazing. Like I was so excited by that. In terms of just like mindset, managing strong emotions, managing strong people, mm-hmm. you know, I think that has been the number one like important force in my life. I also do yoga. That's something that my partner was into when we met, and she kind of like taught me a bunch of things around yoga, and that was also really meaningful for me, because when I was born with kind of like short calf muscles.
Mm.
And so my whole life I have kind of like struggled with very tight legs, and I had surgery when I was like 2 years old to basically like split my calf muscle and like reattach it so I could walk properly as a child. And, you know, at that age, they'd given me a bunch of like exercises to do. And, you know, in the moment, I think they were great. They helped with that recovery, but I don't think that they kind of like took me into adulthood. So, you know, before I started doing yoga, I couldn't touch my toes. Yeah. I did it for 6 months. I could get my whole hand under my feet.
Yeah.
So that was, that for me as well, that was like a really powerful kind of like, wow, I can do something.
Right.
Like this in such a short amount of time, like this practice has given me like mobility.
Yeah.
You know, that was like really wonderful. That was such a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to be able to measure progress using your body.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and that, and that's something that, you know, it comes up in yoga of like, you are not your body, you are, you know, your spirit, mm-hmm. your soul. And so being able to like, even I'm sure in kendo, you've realized if you're injured or, you know, just this week I had like 5 paper cuts and like so many different bruises on my hands, and just in a few days they're going to go away and your body will heal.
Yeah.
So I can measure time by how long this bruise went away.
Yeah, yeah.
I can measure time by how long it took me to reach my toes.
Yeah.
And so there's different ways of like breaking up this sort of like linear approach to life of like, you know, we live by the clock.
Yeah.
And we live by the calendar.
Yeah.
And we live by the ruler. Yeah. These things were all made by humans.
Yeah, they were constructs.
You know?
Yeah.
And the things that we live in all the time, like we've been in this forever, and our ancestors were in this form, and, you know, and the people that come after us will be in this form. And there's something like really special about like, you know, not to get too dystopian, but like if the world does get to a place where like we don't have time, we don't have phones, we don't have any of that, people can still measure time.
Yeah.
People will still be able to measure shadows and create their own sort of notions of, you know, holding space and sort of measuring where we are. So I think there's something really special about like something that is maybe an individual practice like yoga, but it becomes such a collective, you know, act. And I think in that it's very radical and very, very political to say, yeah, I'm going to use my body and stretch it and care for it.
Yeah.
In a world that says like, no, you need to work and you need to produce the best content and you need to produce all these, you know, great things. I think it's a really neat thing that we're able to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a, you know, just through this conversation that we're having, we each have a different experience of it, and so hearing someone else's experiences like can activate things for you as well, where you're like, I never thought about my body in that way, or I should start thinking about that, you know, with time. And yeah, and I think that's the wonderful thing about having conversations about that kind of thing.
Yeah,
you just kind of you can talk forever about it. And there's so many ideas about it, and it just can, it can land on you, and it might activate something right in that moment. You might sit with it for like a couple of years and come back to him and be like, yeah, you know,
yeah,
he said that, it made so much sense.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Something else I've been thinking about too is like body hair.
Yeah.
You know, like I know you have some facial hair. I have facial hair. That's something that we are able to use to measure time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and like, changing our perception of the world and the world's perception of us simply by cutting our hair and letting things grow. And earlier this week, I used to have long hair. I cut my hair a little bit. And I'm like, this is like a year's worth of growth in my hand.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm able to drop it and let the world take it. I'm
able to throw it up. How much was it?
It was like maybe this much. It was like down to here.
Oh, wow.
Like just beneath my chin.
Do you miss it?
It hasn't hit me yet.
Okay.
It hasn't hit me that I cut my hair, you know? Like, and I usually buzz my head a lot, and I've donated my hair twice. So I'm used to the cycle.
Yeah.
And I feel like every so often I get to this moment in my life where, like, I need my external image to reflect the internal change that I'm going through.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm on the precipice of something. So I was like, all right, it's time for a cut. And I did this cut, and I was like, you know, I'm still the same person.
Yeah.
And there's something really nice about that. It's like, I'm still going to be the same person regardless of like this thing that I used to measure time. I can look in a photo of my phone and be like, oh, I know where I was in life. I know year it was because of how long my facial hair is and how long this is. And it's really cool. And I sometimes even like seeing videos of like little children reacting to like their parents, like, or like when they shave the beard and they don't recognize them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I always think about that. That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, that we're like, what we do really impacts someone's memory.
Yeah.
You know,
like those if kids I were to remember that, yeah. their whole life, you know?
You know, so like when this child is like 11, 12, 13, and they think about their father when they're younger, like, will they remember the beard or not?
Yeah.
You know?
I've had the same haircut since I was maybe like 15.
Really?
So when I look back, I don't have that experience.
Yeah.
So I just have to kind of like look at the clothes I'm wearing maybe, or like maybe the emotion that's in my eye in the photo.
Has it gotten softer? Have your eyes been softer?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. I think so.
Nice. So we talked about exercise. I think actually I've had, so I know you and your partner ordered some food from a CSA, from a farm upstate. How did you, maybe the two of you, like come to cross paths with like ordering food? And like, how does maybe like this idea of CSA, does that exist in South London? And when you go back, like, do you notice similar systems of like the food, you know, production, food consumption? Is there similarities and differences that you're able to notice?
Yeah. So I think the kind of the way that Hannah and I sort of interacted with like CSA was we started growing our own food during the pandemic, you know, and that was one like something to do and something that was just like interesting to do. But also, you know, as all these other ideas were like rising up in us, we're like food precarity for ourselves is maybe like a reality in the future, you know? And so we should learn how to like make our own food. We should learn how to like grow stuff.
Understand what goes into the food that comes on our plate.
Yeah, right. And then you realize like, dude, it's so hard to like grow food.
Yeah.
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 It's like, you know, you spend so many hours and you spend like days and then you're like, I have 20 tomatoes. But they're the best tomatoes you've ever had.
Oh, they're incredible.
Yeah. And then, you know, we've also had to deal with like 2020. The atmosphere was like completely different. Like everything grew so good in 2020.
Mm.
In 2021, like there was more pollution. Yeah. And you even just like noticed that. Like that was so weird.
Yeah.
But so yeah, like that was.
But kind also, of, I mean, that's a way to measure time.
It is.
Like you can measure time with pollution and the quality of your tomatoes.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. And it that gives me a lot of hope as well, because you, when you look at like the scientific data of like how the atmosphere changed during the 2020, we can reverse the climate crisis in many like reasonable ways. Like we just have to do it, you know? And disclaimer, that's not like your own carbon footprint. I mean, like as a society, like fuck that, like individual.
Right.
It's your responsibility.
Yeah, putting the burden on people.
Yeah. That's my disclaimer for that.
Yeah. But, an important disclaimer.
So, that was, so I think through that, it was like, okay, we're growing our own food. Let's join a CSA where our neighbors or farms that are kind of near to New York are growing their own food. And I think a big part of the CSA model is that you also have the opportunity to visit that farm. Mm. And that's part of the community model of it. Like you are someone who lives in the city and maybe you don't have access to green space. And so by buying into this CSA, those farmers are also inviting you to their space, and like this is your space as well. You know, you deserve to be here. You have a place here at the farm as well.
Yeah.
And so Hannah's been to like the farm where we currently get the CSA from, which is like an Asian run farm upstate.
Yeah.
That grows specific kind of like Asian
peppers
and
greens,
squashes, and greens, things, that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, that was kind of like where the idea came from for like interacting with that kind of like food network. Mm-hmm. My dream for the hub is to kind of like be able to get that kind of like CSA quality food here as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of the time we do two things, right? We rescue food here and sometimes it's really great quality. Sometimes we have to sift through it, right? And, you know, everyone here, when they like go through this food, like they take out the bad stuff, and that's part of the respect of like, you're getting food for free. It's also going to be good food.
Right.
You know,
we're not going to put something that is not of quality.
Exactly.
You deserve better than that.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry, my train of thought's just like coming back around.
We sift through the food and
And then the other stuff is like we buy food, but we're buying it like with the grant, and then we're trying to buy like as much food for as far as that money will stretch, you know?
Yeah.
And so maybe the quality of that food is probably not organic, you know. So I think the next step of that would be to get that kind of farm fresh food and have that relationship between a place like this in the city and a place out in the countryside that has a farm. And I think it would be like a wonderful like next step of like the work that we do, especially like in food justice.
Yeah.
In terms of like what that looks like in like South London, I don't know. I've been away for a while. What I do know is that the idea of the free fridge is prevalent everywhere.
Oh yeah.
Like I have looked at so many YouTube videos of free fridges in the UK, in London, where I'm from. You know, there's also a big cost of living crisis in the UK, and a lot of people rely on food banks, you know, and it's a different kind of idea because these people are like lining up and they get like a list. As far as I'm aware, like, okay, you can take one thing from this shelf. You can take one thing from this shelf. Someone else is kind of deciding like, okay, this is what you're allowed right now. I think a lot of it is in this like charity model of like, here's what we have. You go and take it on our terms, you know? And there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of shame about going to food banks, you know? So that's kind of like what I've taken from like watching media being away, you know? If I were to go back, I would kind of want to like interact with that and make sure that I kind of understand that world a little bit more fully. So, you know, I can bring everything that I've learned here, a collective focus to it. Yeah.
What's it like to see the place that you grew up through media? Like, are you able to sort of fill in the gaps and sort of, you know, think back to when you were there and still kind of have your frame of reference be like, yeah, I'm in Brooklyn, I'm in New York, where there is such like a very rich culture, cultures, you know, every day there's such a, you know, assemblage of diversity here, to see something in real life here versus to see something through a screen over there. Are you able to sort of like keep some space and some nuance and understand like this is, you know, this is a portrayal or this is like real work, or is there something that you're not seeing that you're sort of like, I wish I could see this and I know what's going on, but it's just hard to access?
You know, it's kind of like when I think about what it makes me think of is, how do people relate to me as an English person or a person from London when I came here, you know? And people would love like talking at me in an English accent, and or maybe you've heard the one that's like, oh, bottle of water,
Oh,
you talk funny, like all this kind of thing. So that has been, I feel like my experience in the US has been like very like coded through like media that other people have taken in.
And sort of just projected at you.
No, it's okay. Yeah, no, it's kind of like, other people experience that as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big part of it. And I got to say it, like Americans have that in the UK. Like I grew up thinking like, oh yeah, Americans are dumb. Americans are stupid. Like, and what it is really is that like they want English people, you know, want to feel better about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, so they're like, oh yeah, there's someone even dumber than us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, when I look back, you know, I guess I lament that a lot of the media that makes it over here that is popular is kind of like this royal stuff or like the gentry or something like Downton Abbey, you know, or the crown that seeks to valorize like that upper crust of society. At the same time, like, I think that the UK and Irish media as well does a really good job of like showing really like every single part of the UK. And I think that's really wonderful. I think one of the best things that I've watched in the last couple of years is a show called Derry Girls, which is about the Troubles. I grew up in England. I was not taught about Ireland.
Yeah.
I still am like very like woefully uninformed about Irish history. And I've been to Northern Ireland, but I've never been to Ireland. And it's something that I've like sought to kind of like educate myself on since coming here. But it's just kind of clear, like, oh, yeah, they don't teach us that because for a reason, you know, they don't want us to know about that.
Yeah. And the Irish have a huge history of like resistance and revolt. And
even
in terms of like food and agricultural subsistence, like the Irish have always maintained that sort of like strong character.
Yeah.
Self, you know.
Like I feel like what English people are taught is like, oh, there was the Irish potato famine, and they weren't smart enough to even grow a potato, or like they only lived on potatoes or some shit like that. And what it really is that like there was like an economic blockade of Ireland, or like the British were like taking pretty much like all of the crops and resources to, you know, Great Britain mainland, right? So it's kind of just like...
They're just usurping all the other...
Yeah. So like, it's just that idea of like what you're kind of like just socialized to be like, oh, this is what that history is, what this, you know, Irish potato famine means. Then you're like, oh, no, the government made that happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I feel sad that was my experience growing up. Mm. And, I read a lot to kind of like educate myself now.
Yeah.
About that history.
Yeah. And thank you for continuing to educate yourself. It's a super hard thing to do. So I also, you know, before we start to wrap up, I want to talk about rest and how you find ways to let yourself rest and let your body rest and let your mind sort of be and relax and sort of have your own downtime. Like what does that look like for you when you're not at the hub, when you're not working, when you're not educating yourself, when you're not doing kendo?
I struggle with it. I struggle to rest. I'm like a restless person, you know? And, you know, even like, so I meditate before I do kendo and like before and after is like, and it's for like 30 seconds tops, you know? We like, we just kind of like meditate and then put our stuff on and then go. Yeah. For me, like rest or like meditation kind of has to be like active. And so that's why I loved, like when I started doing yoga, I was like, oh, this is great because my mind rests, but my body is active, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think where I'm at in my life now is that for me, resting is, it sounds so dumb, but it's like being like fully engaged in one singular thing, because I think that is rare in the world that surrounds us right now. Being fully engaged in one practice.
Right.
Kendo's great for that because we put our armor on, like we're wearing all this equipment, like you can't have your phone on you.
Yeah.
So you know, like you put the it's called a men, the helmet that we wear.
Yeah.
Like you're in for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
Like anything could happen in the world, but you won't know.
You're inside your helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think for me that I get rest, or kind of like I get the feeling of rest from like doing that really engaged experience. And then I always get runner's high after doing that, you know, like I'll finish up, I'll take my stuff off and I'll feel like, That's for me is like one of the best feelings in my life.
Yeah.
Just like finishing that practice.
Yeah.
And then so in that moment, I'm like, yeah, I did it. I trained really hard. Like I was able to accomplish some things that I wanted to. Maybe I got beaten in other ways. And so the brain is like firing all those synapses, you know, and like all those learnings are kind of being like, you know, taken in. And then that's where I feel like that rest, you know, where I'm like, okay, I did something, you know. Yeah. So I think that's my roundabout way of answering the question.
No, but you answered it. And rest is, I find this a lot in people who organize and who are very interested in and involved in direct action and mutual aid, is like rest is really hard to come by.
Yeah.
And rest is really hard to prioritize. Because so often, like you said, we walk in on a Tuesday distro, there's things to be done.
Yeah.
But something I learned when I first started organizing, somebody had like given this presentation about how rest is liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like to be able to rest is, and to be able to choose rest in moments where there is things to do is resistance.
Yeah.
Again, in this hyperactive world that we've inherited, where we're constantly told and constantly distracted by all these things that we have to contend with, choosing to rest is radical. And so being able to lean into that and to be comfortable and not hold shame is something that, like, it does take active, you know, participation and choosing to be seen resting.
Mm-hmm.
And like
to be seen resting.
To be seen and that's something that, like, I used to organize in LA for, you know, 2 or 3 years, and we didn't have a physical space.
Uh-huh.
And so when I came here, I was like, oh, this is so cool. The hub is like a physical mutual aid spot. There's a brick and mortar, there's a space, and I would come in and there's always people and I love it. And sometimes on these Tuesday distros, there's things to be done, and the way I was raised, if there's something to be done, I'm going to do it, you know, or to figure out, you know. But then slowly you realize that, like, there's a lot of people and we have enough hands to do the things that need to be done.
Yeah.
And so it's totally okay if somebody wants to, like, sit in the meditation room and cool off for 5 minutes, or, you know, the line is getting out of hand and somebody needs to come in. I think those pockets of time are so crucial. Yeah. And anytime I do see somebody, like, maybe becoming overwhelmed, I'm trying to encourage them to go inside, like, hey, we can take over, like, go take a rest. And I think last week I came in and I was kind of hungry and I was like, you know, I'm gonna eat some oatmeal.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, stuff to be done outside, but I was like, I'm gonna try to be an example to the people around me and say, you don't always have to be.
Yeah, you don't have to be like.
You don't always, like, that is,
you know, most important person, even like, oh, let me help you do this.
Right. Yeah. Because by doing that, we fall into this cycle of like living for other people.
Yeah.
You know, and even though we're trying to make a better world for the people around us, like, we have to be able to live for ourselves.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so being able to choose, like, you know, I'm going to figure out how to get myself situated and get myself centered and get myself correct so that I can go out and help and be a better person.
And I think the important part of that as well, like, to be seen resting is, you know, I think one of the favorite things people like to say is like, oh, we have no bosses here at Collective Focus, you know, and maybe people like myself who are like new to mutual aid, you know, when you come in here, you're responsible for yourself.
Right.
And you're responsible for like the actions that you take. And so to that point, like if you need rest, if you come in here, you need to do something, you shouldn't feel that you're going to be like policed.
Yeah.
And also other people shouldn't feel that they can like look at you and be like, oh, well, you should be doing this.
Pass judgment.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because then, you know, we're pointing fingers at each other.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When we could be holding hands and trying to fight, you know,
yeah,
the oppressive systems that are keeping us, you know, and telling us like we need to be policing each other and passing all these. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's a really important part of like being in here and like using this space. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. I think there is maybe some few like rapid fire $1 million questions. If you're for it.
Oh, yeah. I've been waiting for this.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah. You guys want to say it?
Yeah.
Okay. I like this first one. Can you create better in comfort or in the struggle?
I like comfort.
Yeah.
I like, in terms of like creation, I'm someone who's not, in terms of like my creative practice, I'm not like that spontaneous. And so, you know, I need things to be like set up and I need things to kind of be in a place where I kind of like walk into it. Everything's there. I've like set it up.
Yeah.
It's like a clean slate, both like mentally and like everything is set up, and then I can create.
Yeah. So
that's how I feel about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and you work in video too, so I'm sure your desk and your setup and having things.
Yeah, my desk is clean.
Yeah, always.
I got nothing on it. Yeah,
always.
Yeah.
How often do you clean your space or your room? Is it, do you let yourself get messy?
I let myself get messy. Yes, yeah. Definitely. At work, I keep the desk like fully clean. I'm pretty much like cleaning it at the end of every day.
Yeah.
So then when I come in the next day, it's like,
yeah,
it's like set up and I can kind of like engage in it.
Yeah. Mad respect.
Yeah.
When I worked a desk job, it was super messy. Like all the time. And like, you know, they say to like, you know, close all the programs and like let your computer sleep at the end of the day, and like I would just shut it.
Yeah,
and I'd open the next day, and this is something I'm you know, still getting my way out of, is like closing out of tabs.
Yeah,
I have so many tabs open, so many windows of like, I probably have like 150 tabs open across all my windows, and I realize that like this gets at my mental space.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm like inbox zero. I close every tab before the end of the day, and I shut down my computer every
mad
night.
Respect. Mad respect. That's 1992 coded.
Yeah. It's like, that's because I feel like, you know, I grew up when computers had to be turned off.
Yeah.
You know, now, like,
yeah,
you don't have to turn computers off.
Yeah. 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 But it's something that, like, as I'm getting older now, I'm like, you know, this isn't, I like to think that I can operate in this chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to operate in this, like, I can do it. But it's like, I don't think this is the best way for my brain.
Yeah.
And like, you know, letting myself accept that and be like, okay,
yeah,
we should maybe reevaluate.
Yeah,
it's like, okay, I'm showing up for myself in a way that the younger me probably wouldn't be open to.
Yeah.
Yeah. next question is couch hopping or a queen size bed?
Say that again.
Couch hopping or a queen size bed? What's more appealing?
I like couch hopping. I can sleep pretty well. So, you know, I can sleep everywhere, even on the subway sometimes.
Really?
You know? So, I don't, obviously, like, I have a comfortable bed at home and, like, I enjoy sleeping on that most of the time. But in terms of, like, the sense of, like, being in places or whatever, like, I'm happy to kind of, like, just kind of, like, be in a place and experience it. And not getting a good night's sleep is not, like, particularly destructive to me.
Yeah. So you're okay with sleeping on couches as long as your desk is clean.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
but that kind of makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because
that's your waking state.
Yeah, I stayed at my friend's place like a week ago, and I slept on the sofa.
Yeah,
but I tidied up all my stuff was like in my case. You know, every before I went to sleep, and then when I wake up again, I would kind of get it all out again. So that's the balance.
That's nice. That makes a lot of sense. And then this last question is a low budget or a large budget?
I've been thinking about this one a lot because
okay.
I know that this is one that has been asked like a lot.
Let us hear it.
And I got to say large budget, but I'm going to break it a little bit because it's, you know, I think that there's like power in longevity, you know, and I think that things that get built over time and are sustainable and are kind of like repeatable, whether it's like the Tuesday distro or, you know, my kendo practice, which, you know, it's the same time every week. We do the same drills.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is like power and energy in like doing things the same way over time, giving people that basis of like, this is here for you.
Mm-hmm.
This resource is here for you. And I think that that does take some level of budget to do that. You know, it has to be sustainable. And so for me, whether it's like the kind of like the creative practice of that or just like what it means to me as someone who like interacts with that practice, I'm interested in things that are like repeatable, have budget, like have a time frame for people to like step in and out of them and for that to like support their life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you like when things are like fully finished? Or do you like sort of like dragging things out and sort of like preserving just a little bit?
I love to finish something.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's admirable.
And, you know, I think that's one of the wonderful things about like the Tuesday distro here at the Hub is that it's like, it's done, the food is gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that part of it is done. Because there's so many things here that are constant, you know, this space is a constant support for people.
Mm-hmm.
And to have something like a food distro where, like, the food is gone, you know, that, I think, is really important for our own kind of, like, sense of, like, what we're doing here as well.
Yeah.
You know?
And creating that sense of closure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And knowing that, you know, the next week there will be more food.
Yeah.
And being able to open things back up and close them and becoming comfortable with, like, the cycle of how things go.
And then you realize, like, food is a resource, you know?
Yeah.
And it's finite. And that is something to be, like, protected if you kind of want to move through the rest of your life with this, like, abundance mindset, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's kind of, like, a good balance in just taking that idea of, like, yeah, we're done today.
Yeah.
But we're not checked out.
Mm.
You know.
Mm. Yeah. Right on. This last question is a two-part thought process.
Okay.
What would you tell your 16-year-old self? And then what would you tell yourself around the time when you just moved to Brooklyn?
16-year-old self, one of my big regrets in life, and I touched on this previously, was that I studied acting and I gave it up, basically, because I thought I wasn't good enough. And in that, I lost the joy of the practice of it.
Yeah.
You know, in that time, I was finding joy in, like, other practices in my life, so I don't really, like, feel too much, like, oh, I messed up, you know? And I wouldn't change how I've lived my life. But in that moment, I gave up on myself.
Yeah.
And so I think that I would, like, encourage my 16-year-old self to, like, look at the talented people around me, which there were so many, you know, actors. And, like, I looked up to them, my friends, you know, because I could just tell they just had much more stage presence than me.
Yeah.
They felt those emotions, like, stronger than me. Or at least that's what I felt.
Yeah.
You know? And so I would tell my 16-year-old self not to give up after that kind of, like, failure of not getting into a school, which wasn't even, like, a failure, really, you know? And to continue, like, finding what was it about acting that was joyful to you, and go back to that, you know? And when I think about that of my life now, I'm like, I'd love to do Shakespeare again.
Yeah.
It's like, so it's like the most basic, like, English person answer, but I love it. I love Shakespeare. So
do you miss the performance aspect of acting? And do you feel like you get that in kendo a bit?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
What I miss, what I struggled with was when I was acting was playing characters that were, like, contemporary.
Okay.
And so I like playing archetypes, you know, because this person symbolizes pure valor. This person is pure evil. This person is pure greed.
Mm.
And you go to that point in the character and you take in all the stereotypes or whatever that you've learned in your life.
Yeah.
And then it begins to fall away and you're like, okay, where does this character kind of begin to live when you peel back all of those things that you've been socialized to think about someone who is greedy, who has valor, who is, you know, any of these things. So I think that's the wonderful process and something that I would love to kind of, like, reunite with at some point in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. That about covers it for me. Is there anything else you...
But did I cover the second part of it?
No, you didn't. Oh, okay. 23-year-old.
23. Oh, yeah.
23, 24, when you first moved, yeah.
No, you know, I think that I wouldn't change anything I wouldn't tell myself too much. You know, I think that moving abroad was something that I dreamed of from a young age. You know, in my kendo club, I was surrounded by people from around the world, from Europe, Asia, America. And so I always wanted to be one of those people, you know, one of these people that had moved to another place.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I was 23 and I moved here, I'd accomplish this dream, that this thing that I became the person that I wanted to be, that I was the
young people that growing up. Yeah.
So, I would let 23-year-old Josh, like, live that, because I had, like, accomplished something for myself and I don't think that I needed the input or like the outside input in that moment. I think it's really important for me to like work out where I go from there, you know, and I'm mm-hmm. still working that out.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm going to like chill on, yeah. on him. I'm not going to whisper anything in his ear.
What about like a 26, 27 year old Josh?
Hmm.
Could he have perceived where you would be now?
I think so, yeah. You know, but one thing I didn't talk about was that like what really like spurred me to join the hub at that time in my life was like I was like feeling very depressed, mm. you know, and I needed some kind of like external like energy to kind of like come in
and draw you out, and, yeah.
you know, so maybe, you know, like. I would have been like, yeah, go find mutual aid. That's the thing.
Purpose,
maybe
yeah.
I did. Like, yeah. maybe I really actually did because I think that I've, like, I can't think of anything that helped me in that moment when I was feeling really depressed more yeah. than, like, this community.
Mm.
I, like, literally, I don't think there's anything else yeah. that I could have found that would have been better for me in that moment.
Yeah.
So... that makes me think that perhaps I did
yeah.
at some point go back and plant this idea,
yeah.
you know, because, yeah, I'm just like astounded by the wonderful people that are at Collective Focus, that the community that we help and like
yeah. the energy the that it brings in.
Yeah.
yeah.
And, I feel like so much gratitude to like, the people that make this space and the people who also, you know, use this space as well for yeah. the resources that we help,
yeah.
you know, give out.
Do you think your maybe lack of this type of community played a part in like why you were feeling a bit depressed around that time? Or was there just a confluence of things that you think having access to a community or being part of a community sort of alleviated all those other, you know, burdens or tensions or stresses?
For me, I was focusing on my own emotions really intently. Like, I'm feeling like this. I'm feeling like this. I'm feeling all these strong things.
Yeah.
And to, you know, I think that the beginning of it was like, I'm going to go help people. So I'm going to feel good about myself. And that's where I was in that kind of like, I want to do charity kind of mindset.
Yeah.
And then that was what was wonderful about discovering mutual aid was that like I'm gonna help myself through helping other people, but the relation, like, I'm gonna have to open myself up to being helped,
yeah,
you know, like that was what helped me.
Yeah.
I couldn't give myself away to feel better. I also had to receive,
yeah,
you know. And so that's why I kind of think that like I found it just right at the right time that I needed it because, you know, I could imagine that I could have joined like a charity, you know, maybe just giving out resources, like just giving stuff
figuring
to people.
Figuring out the one way, the yeah. right path and just trying to figure out, you know.
Or just like people telling me, okay, go get that stuff, like give it to that person.
Yeah.
And like that relationship would have been so much different, both like to the neighbors that are getting those resources and to myself.
Yeah.
And so, I don't think that would have like really helped me at all. I would have just felt like, oh, I'm doing this because I feel like I have to.
Yeah.
You know? Whereas now with the mutual aid, I'm like, I'm doing this because like when I do it, I feel just like this is how I want to organize my life.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
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 It's as much for me as it is for anyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a very extremely valid way of looking at it. And that's something I think too. It's like the most selfish thing I can do is help people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and
yeah,
it sounds so like just kind of stupid and maybe cheesy, but it's like, it's true. It's like, I get so much from this type of work and the people that I'm helping and the people that I'm being in community with that, you know, that's what keeps me going and coming back.
Yeah. 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 I could go on about, like, you know, people like to argue, like, oh, is altruism real?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Let's not get into that. Yeah.
yeah. Good call. but yeah, I guess with that, that about wraps it up. Any closing remarks on your end or anything you want to shout out?
I want to say thank you to you, Jay, because we crossed paths like a couple of times, but like, damn, I feel like I think that you know me probably pretty well, but now I have like so many questions for you.
Yeah.
And I'm like excited to get to know you much deeper. I want to shout out like Johan, Rohan, know, because this project is like awesome.
So fantastic.
And yeah, shout out like everyone at the Hub. There's too many to list.
Yeah.
If you want to hear my list, you got to come to the Hub and check it out. And then like by extension, you will be on the list too. If you're like a person who hasn't interacted with the Hub before.
So pull up.
Pull up. Yeah.
Pull up.
Yeah. Which is like my last name. Pull up, right? Pull up.
Hell yeah. Awesome. Sweet. Thank you. Can I give you a hug?
Yeah, you can.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Yeah. Come some later.